Welcome to The Gauge, a new podcast brought to you by Green Gauge, the first fully integrated financial services group, bridging the traditional financial services space with the new digital innovations in crypto assets and blockchain. In episode 2, Green Gauge's CEO Sean Kiernan speaks to digital assets lawyer Charles Kerrigan about what is blockchain for, how traditional finance is digitizing, and where the technology is really being used in today's markets.
Welcome to the second episode of The Gauge, Green Gauge's podcast interviewing leading lights in the digital asset space. I'm delighted to be joined with Charles Kerrigan, who's one of the preeminent lawyers in the space, in both crypto and digital assets, having set up a dedicated practice within CMS. We've also featured Charles twice in our APPG blockchain report with the UK Parliament in 2018 and 2021. Charles, delighted to have you with us.
Thanks, Sean. Very happy to be here.
Charles and I have been speaking for a few years on quite a few topics in the digital asset space. And we thought today to focus really on the intersection between digital assets and financial services. Charles, what are some areas that you think are kind of shaping the digital asset space right now that might have an interface with financial services of relevance?
That's a very big question. I think the starting place is to see digital assets and crypto not just as those crypto native tokens or things that emerge from them and make their way into financial services, but as a digitalization tool for financial services. We've seen that trend develop from the emergence of fintechs and neobanks, from better user interfaces provided by all financial institutions, and from the customers of financial institutions getting more crypto friendly. So the standards that they're expecting are rising. And we've also got the market infrastructure that has a significant role to play here. We've, to some extent, fixed the front end. So those apps and things that I'm describing are better, far better than they were. But a lot of the back end remains the same. And whether that's servicing crypto and digital assets or whether it's servicing traditional assets, the issues are by and large the same. So one of the frustrations I think that the community has around this, people who are working on these fintech problems, is that it can be an issue that the institutions see anything around digital assets as being related to crypto. So we have to pull that apart and say there's a significant part of it that's related to crypto, but equally a significant part about how digitalization improves financial services in the mainstream, the market infrastructure. And so in that context, we're often talking about the digitalization of traditional instruments, debt and equity and similar, not about the native crypto assets. That intersection is one of the key areas. We're likely to see the barrier fall, and it will become apparent that we're talking about many of the same things. But for the moment, if we have that barrier down the middle, it makes it easier for us to have the conversation around digitalization without being drawn too far into crypto and all of the barriers that we see in the traditional markets in relation to crypto, albeit they're starting to lower as we speak.
I think it's a really fascinating journey, and I'm sure you being at the coalface, having worked with many firms as they explore digital assets, must be a really fascinating position to be in. Could you talk to some of your day-to-day experience and how you've come up with the idea to build effectively a digital asset-focused practice?
It comes from the need to service the clients in the way that they are looking for lawyers to engage with them. So it's well known that lawyers are traditionally relatively siloed within their organization into the topics that are legal subjects. So you have corporate lawyers who know the Companies Act and related legislation. You have banking lawyers that know how lending and borrowing transactions work. You've got financial regulation lawyers that know the FCA and similar rule books. The crypto clients, and still to a large extent the digital assets clients in that traditional market, can't see the world in the same way. They come with business problems. They often don't come with legal questions. They need a lawyer to be able to help them frame what the legal problems are. So they will come and say, we want to launch this product, or we want to develop a new business division of the following type. And it's up to us to say, well, this touches on the following range of legal questions. What they don't then want us to do is hand them off to six different lawyers and say, myself, together with five colleagues, will be able to work on that project for you. It's inefficient, it doesn't seem aligned with what the business is trying to do. So part of the logic behind us developing this group is to have people who've got sufficient understanding in each of those legal subjects that I've described, but more than that, a good understanding of the business problems that the clients are trying to solve. And this is where we do bring in people from crypto firms. If you've got a crypto background, it tends to be easier to advise on a digital bond issuance because you know the benefits of crypto, you know the background to how these things are developing. The clients, again, are relatively, really very diverse, actually. So some of this work involves acting for pure crypto firms, some of it for mainstream financial institutions, and lots of diversity around each part of that. The institutions may be less so, although that's changing, but within the crypto space, you've got firms that have now been around for 10 years, you've got entrepreneurs setting up new businesses, you've got the top-end mathematicians that are working on the deep tech and those technical aspects of projects. So a really broad range of people that you need to work with. What I think we've found is it's easier to teach the additional legal aspects to crypto lawyers than it is to teach the crypto to the traditional lawyers. So we've hired lawyers out of the in-house legal departments of crypto firms. And that was probably a bit of a breakthrough for us because it meant that we weren't having to ask the clients questions that they hoped we'd know the answer to. And we were attuned to their way of working. They tend to like to work through workshops more than detailed legal memos and so on. So it definitely hasn't been something that we did overnight. It's taken 3 or 4 years of creeping forward a bit more each time. And with each new hire, we've had to make the case again. So as far as the organization is concerned, CMS has been supportive, but supportive against us being able to demonstrate that we've got the client demand, we've got revenues, we're able to be profitable in doing this, we're able to manage our risk and not work with clients that would be unsuitable for a large international law firm. So it's hard work, but it's the most terrifically engaging and interesting job that I think I can imagine a lawyer having. And more lawyers should become crypto lawyers. It's an opportunity to work with your friends, as the old startup cliche. You don't get say much of that as a lawyer. It's often the case that in large law firms, only clients of a certain size and stature can be onboarded. But in crypto, that breaks down. So alongside that client mix that I say of all the large financial institutions, we've got individuals as clients that we've been surprised have been terrific clients for us because they're committed to the project, they're well capitalized, the project has been truly innovative and different. That range of things is really just a joy to be involved in.
It's fascinating to hear how much fun you're having, and it sounds quite exciting. And the way you describe the different mindset of the people that you've built the team with, as well as the people that you're taking on as clients, what do you think is behind that different mindset?
It's not something that I've thought about a lot before. So I'm thinking now through the people that I work with every day, and I'm the oldest by some way. So I'm pretty reliant on some of the younger ones. We've all been personally interested and invested in crypto for some time now. Mm. So we're following the same projects, newsletters, and similar, but we've got different views of them, that tends to come together. So a lot of the work that we do, we co-write the notes and memos and project documents because everybody's bringing in a different aspect to it. I'm probably at the more legalistic end of that, so still focused on the regulations, risk management, and similar. The more junior members of the team are more interested in technical aspects of smart contracts or bringing in those practical examples. I think we can see it's not difficult to write a briefing note on, let's say, DAOs or Web3 metaverse projects. They're the things that are most active at the moment. There's plenty of information. There are no laws, so you can't go to a textbook and pull something out. You've got to be able to apply not necessarily regulation, because taking DAOs as an example, the FCA doesn't say anything about DAOs, the Companies Act doesn't say anything about DAOs. So you've got to be a broad common lawyer who understands legal principles, how governance is viewed behind the legislation that we've got at the moment to see how these things are built in theory. You've got to understand consumer protections, how consumers are protected from harm in relation to projects. You've got to understand aspects of payments, intellectual property, a really broad range of topics that aren't necessarily mapped directly onto the kind of questions that the clients are asking. But when we sit together as a team, different people have got different views of that. So plugging all of those things in together, I think, means that we are better able to provide something that's practically useful. We know lots of other projects, and so when we're advising in relation to a new project, we can say, this has got similarities with Project X that we worked on. It's got similarities with Project Y that we didn't work on, but we know something about. It is different to Project Z, but there are things that we think are analogous in there, so we write those in. So I think trying to get from something which is generic and useful to an extent to a client into something where the advice is specific and bespoke and responds not just to that legal environment that I'm describing, the rules that are sitting behind this, but also to what's going on in the market, what other projects are doing, what approach they've taken, how the market is viewing things. And we're starting to see issues being revealed as projects are running on. So that's from scams and hacks and rug pulls and all of those things that are problematic. As a lawyer, if you're thinking about risk management, you should have a view on how those things have happened and how they could have been avoided. I'm pleased to say that we haven't been specifically involved in any projects that have suffered that fate. So thank you to our onboarding and client diligence team and the various partners that we work with in that. But it's always a possibility that we are concerned about. But each of those provides lessons for the next piece of work that we're doing. We're seeing not just crypto-specific venture capital firms, but traditional venture capital firms now coming into crypto quite hard and taking tokens, not just equity. And so working with those clients, we try to establish what's their understanding of smart contracts. Do they have policies around audit requirements for smart contracts and a token issuance, diligence in relation to the team members, an understanding of voting rights and the balances that are to be struck in that. So trying to get to both a checklist of these issues so we can be somewhat consistent, but then ensure that they're applied on a bespoke basis for each project. It's hard work, and the way we advise changes quite a lot as time goes by and the projects are developing. But I think that's a function of the fact that we have to follow the market if we're going to be crypto asset and digital asset lawyers in that part of the market as well as the traditional products, we've got to be on our toes and able to respond to those changes, both good and bad, and legislative changes that keep coming through in all jurisdictions where crypto assets are getting across regulators' desks, which is pretty much everywhere now.
Yeah, I mean, you must be at a really interesting intersection. I mean, it's almost what you've described, a consultancy role, where you have to take each individual case, think through actually, maybe this is what the client says they want, but this is maybe what's achievable or realistic. And I think that the trends you've described, and I asked you a fairly unfair question in the first one, which is very broad, but seem to deal, if I may, into two broad camps. One is in infrastructure changes with the plumbing of financial services and the improvements in efficiency and cost and what that can unfold. And then more broadly, around the aspect of capital raising itself. And so I'm going to ask you a very specific question. In the traditional world, obviously you mentioned digital debt and securities as another form of raising money. Do you think that the blockchain opens up new ways of raising money outside of the worlds of securities or the traditional ways?
So it is in theory, but not necessarily in practice. And I don't think I've seen many, if any, successful capital raising projects using blockchain and tokenized securities. So I should explain why that's the case. Because I do for sure believe in the benefits of tokenization being providing liquidity for private assets, for private markets. So blockchain and tokenization can absolutely bring liquidity into private capital markets. But if we're having a conversation with a firm that, say, has a lot of real estate on its balance sheet, they've heard about tokenization, they think it's a good way of accessing capital, the starting point, I think, is to say, why have you not done a public issue of securities to date? And the answer is likely to be because the cost of going through the production of a prospectus and complying with the rules relating to public offers of securities is disproportionate. If you've got real estate, there are lots of people who will provide equity to you or lend you debt against the value of your real estate, and that's cheap and efficient and not difficult to do. So the businesses that are coming from that perspective tend to sometimes suffer from a misapprehension that tokenization is a route to retail investors and therefore will enable the raising of capital in a much more diverse and efficient way. It will, technically, but not legally. And so if you've not been accessing retail investors already, you shouldn't see tokenization as a way to access them, because you're going to bump up against all the same regulations that were the reason why you weren't doing it in the first place. However, different business models will come along and address this problem. So if your aim is to build a platform that complies with the regulations and enables businesses to raise capital in a way that uses blockchain and is compliant on a broad basis, then that's something that's worth talking about. And there are examples of that are starting to become apparent. Hedgehog Invest is one of those. At the small end, it's a relatively small business that I've been working with. And it's just done a tokenized security issue for a piece of commercial real estate in the US. It's done it on a somewhat prototype basis, so navigating through the regulations by not going out to the wider public. At the other end of the spectrum, you'd see the large fund managers all working on exactly this problem. And there was some press comment just a couple of days ago about Aberdeen and Citi working together on a tokenized securities project. So this is happening at all ends of the spectrum. It's important to recognize that tokenization isn't a business model. You've got to have a business model that tokenization improves, rather than just take tokenization to to be a shortcut around regulation and to retail investors. That is absolutely the thing that horrifies regulators, and the FCA is still troubled by the reaction to customers losing funds in relation to the London Capital retail bond issue. And that's some years ago now, and it still feeds into their view of crypto and digital assets firms. So you should, with a good understanding of blockchain, be able to identify relatively quickly what it maps onto and what it doesn't map onto. And we generally say that, you know, the purpose of blockchain working in multi-party transactions is a good heuristic for whether it would do something for the business model that you've got. So we use blockchain in things like supply chain financing structures, famously in the case of things like Marco Polo and TradeLens. But you can see there the whole point of it is there's a long chain with lots of parties in it who don't have trusted relationships with each other, don't have any relationships with each other. So that's different. If you're a real estate company, you don't need a distributed database because your shareholders will be listed on your in-house computer. So supply chain finance, which has been probably one of the best early use cases for blockchain in the traditional markets, is a good example of why blockchain is useful, because the facts on the ground are so different to a traditional private company and capital raising. I think the place that we see coming is adoption by tokenization of funds, so it will come through to the fund management, asset management industry. Not necessarily because it's super efficient on the first transaction. The first transaction is quite likely to be more expensive than cloning the previous transaction that you did. But the ability to then scale, repeat, and get the benefits of that across the business are substantial, and we'll see it through the tokenization of bonds. There have been a number of digital bond issuances, again, kind of prototypes. The World Bank has publicized its blockchain bond. There have been a couple of prototypes by commercial entities as well. These are small transactions within, to some extent, walled environments, but they prove out the technology in the model. So now we know the technology works, we know what the regulatory obstacles are, is finding the business models that are going to be successful at marrying those two things together.
I might ask you two questions off the back. I mean, this is a really rich discussion. But one is, in terms of the traditional way of structuring security, obviously there's economies of scale if this is digitized and parameterized, if you will. And over time, I think we're not there yet. I would agree that perhaps the cost point that we're looking at is still not too different from a traditional security issuance. But over time, I would like to hear your thoughts. Where do you think that will move, and how that will move? And the second question would be, do you see routes to funding outside of securities law? And to give you an example, I think NFTs have opened up a whole range of concepts, perhaps project-based funding, which isn't necessarily a security, but provides some kind of income. That, to me, is fascinating, and I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on both those questions.
It's two hard questions. I probably have a short answer for the first one, but not very revealing. So, do I think that in 5 or 10 years, all securities issuances, debt and equity and funds, will be effectively digitalized? Yes, absolutely. Can I tell you exactly how we get there from here? No. And I will say at that point that limitations of time stop me from going further into that. The second question is, I think, a great one for illustrating the hard cases around digital assets and crypto. So I'll come to NFTs, but before that, we are wrestling with the consequences now of the announcement by the FCA in the UK in the last few days that they will bring crypto assets within the financial promotion regime. So what does that mean? Well, they crypto assets have been outside the regulatory perimeter, as the FCA calls it. In other words, types of assets that the FCA regulates since the beginning of time. And for our purposes, the beginning of time is 2009-10 relating to Bitcoin. It wasn't on the FCA's radar then, but we're pretty clear that Bitcoin isn't a security because it doesn't look like a security. There's no issuer, it's not redeemable, it doesn't have those characteristics of a security. So the FCA helped us out in 2019 by giving some guidance which essentially supported the advice that lawyers in this market were already giving. If a crypto asset had characteristics of a security, it would be inside the regulatory perimeter, it would be subject to all of the regulation that applies to all other securities. But if it didn't have those characteristics, it was outside the perimeter. Hence, this distinction between security tokens and utility tokens. Security tokens in, utility tokens out. Go back to my previous answer. You can't do a real estate fundraising transaction without it being asset-backed with recourse to the real estate. So it must be, in concept, a security issuance. We can say that without looking at any white paper for almost every real estate tokenization transaction that comes through. The crypto assets that have generally been traded in the market are utility tokens. And we also know that because market practice has evolved from the exchanges, the centralized exchanges, to by and large require developers to get a legal opinion from someone like us confirming that their token is a utility, not a security, because the exchanges don't want to be running unlicensed securities exchanges. So this distinction is well established. The concern that the regulator has about consumer harm, and this is the adverts for Bitcoin, etc., on buses, leads them to attack the problem through the financial promotions regime. The financial promotions regime saying that only authorized firms or firms that are working with an authorized firm to get their promotion signed off may issue promotions for broadly financial instruments. Until now, those financial instruments have not included crypto assets because they've been outside the regulatory perimeter. But from as soon as possible, when the FCA can get this law through, they tell us that they're going to bring them inside the regulatory perimeter. So we have the slight inconsistency that they will be outside the regulatory perimeter for securities regulation, but inside it for the purposes of financial promotions. So you'd be able to issue them, but not advertise them, to put it in very broad terms. That sounds really confusing, but you can't really argue with how we get here, because I think most of the industry figures something needs to be done if consumers are investing significantly, retail consumers are investing significantly in untested tokens and putting capital at risk, then there is a consumer harm issue floating around. And it's one of the beauties of crypto that there are at least two or three answers to every question that you're ever asked about crypto. So this is in direct contradiction of one of the philosophies of crypto from the start, that it's a democratizing technology, that I can invest alongside Mark Andreessen of A16Z in a project that I can find on the internet or in a Discord group or similar. So we're looking at all these trade-offs, and I think the FCA has moved quickly. It's caused some confusion and alarm in relation to the business models for lots of the crypto firms that are operating in the UK now or accessing UK customers from outside the UK. So we're all lawyers in the space are currently working through the implications of this with clients, but it demonstrates that there's no easy way of addressing these problems. I think for sure blockchain will be used in capital raising because it's apparent what it can do. The success of some of the crypto assets demonstrates how efficiently and easily it is possible to raise capital for new technology projects. A utility token must be a technology project, not a security. But equally, it reveals the difficulties in the market, particularly around consumer harm and I'd say education. It's one thing for the crypto kids to be investing in these things. They're by and large recycling a lot of the gains that they've made in other crypto projects. So it's free money. They're not losing money, they're taking paper losses on huge crypto gains. That's not the same as someone finding something on the side of a bus, downloading an app, and then taking an exposure from their savings into a speculative crypto asset. It reveals, I think, that these assets are really hard to characterize. So a lot of the innovation drives the fact that they are still kind of like securities, even when they're utility tokens, in the sense that they can be investments. They're investable if you have an appetite for significant investment risk and you don't mind losing most or all of your capital. Volatile assets, high risk assets, they can make significant gains, they can make significant losses. Nobody knows which one it's likely to be for a particular project. So these are really, really hard cases. And I think we feel for the regulators. We work extremely closely with the regulators. It's difficult to bring regulation through. So this, again, is an example. The FCA has said that they're proposing regulation. So financial promotions rules will be changed, but they haven't been changed yet. And of course, there are still lots of projects bouncing around. And then very briefly, I should jump to the question about NFTs. So I'm going to pick a narrow way of responding to the question from my perspective. I've worked in the financial markets for 25 years now. One of the things that is obviously a terrific innovation for us is a non-fungible instrument that with authority demonstrates that the holder is entitled to the rights that go along with that instrument. So again, if we jump back to equity or debt, people very regularly lose their share certificates in private companies and other types of companies. So share certificates are not determinative of ownership. The register of members is determinative of ownership. So to give a very trite example, NFTs will effectively stop that gap from existing. The NFT will be a record of ownership on the ledger. That ledger can be the register of members, subject in the UK to a bit of tweaking of the Companies Act, which has already taken place in some companies. So there are some really obvious use cases for NFTs that are nothing to do with colorful llamas or anything that we're seeing in the brand extension markets. And again, it's difficult because when we work on NFT projects, we're sometimes working for crypto firms that are effectively the intermediaries, the service providers. We're sometimes working for the developers, they're crypto people. We're sometimes working for large corporates, sports teams or sports governing bodies, museums, art galleries, you name it, that want to do a brand extension project. And in each case, we're trying to pick through with the relevant client, is this a project that is about brand extension, or is it about investing? Is it about technical innovation? Is it about democratization? Is it a piece of fun that's going to bring people to a festival in a few months? Are people intended to speculate in these tokens and with a following win generate some gains? These are quite hard questions that we generally don't find. If people come to us in our traditional work and say, we've got a fintech project. If someone says, you know, I want to apply for a banking license, then it's obvious. You get the form, the banking license application form, and you fill it in. There's a lot more to it than that. But you don't say, well, you know, what kind of a banking license, or why do you want a banking license? Do you just want people to have heard of you, or do you want to run a bank? I don't remember seeing anything in my career to date where each new project or instruction comes with so much, we have to ask so many additional questions to try and work out what the right approach would be for us and for the project in all these areas.
But what I find so fascinating about the way you've answered that question is, going back to the previous question around the mindset of someone that can do what you do, which is distill the key elements of what a client wants and bring them into this new and innovative space. To me, it comes with an aspect of curiosity and humility, ultimately, where you can listen to someone and kind of decipher what they're trying to do, but help them shape it. And I think that juxtaposition you mentioned of the utility and security shaping of the tokens and what role they play, one can completely understand and sympathize, as we both do, with the regulator's role in this. As traditional, say, vouchers or coupons, the historic assets that behave most similarly to utility tokens, the Avios from British Airways or Nectar Points from Sainsbury's, do not have secondary markets. They do not have people investing life savings from a retail consumer in them. And so this is an entirely new asset. And I think what you're kind of intimating is that as these things evolve, there will be new ways and angles that not just regulators, but the market needs to respond and self-regulate to protect consumers, but also do things responsibly. I found this very interesting, as I always do find our discussions. I wanted just to leave you with some closing comments, and thank you again for your time, if you'd like to say anything.
Thanks, Sean. Well, you've kind of encapsulated it. So, yeah, I wouldn't want anybody to infer from the fact that I just rattled on for 20 or 30 minutes that we have answers to all of these questions. It goes back to the point around there's pretty significant teamwork involved here. And that's not just inside the firm with the colleagues that I've described. We work together closely with, there aren't many, but the handful of lawyers at other firms that are working in crypto and digital assets. And we also work closely with the in-house lawyers at the crypto firms, not just the in-house lawyers at the crypto firms that are clients. We're all trying to share the knowledge, and we're pretty open with clients. We know some things. We definitely don't know everything, but the rules change pretty frequently and the business models change all the time. So there's no possibility of knowing everything. We just need more crypto lawyers. So my closing comment is, I hope anybody who's listening to this that thinks they'd like to be a crypto lawyer will get in touch with those of us that are doing it and come and join the fun.
Thank you very much, Charles.
Thanks.
Thanks for joining us. You've been listening to The Gauge, GreenGage's monthly podcast series. Subscribe to the podcast to stay informed of all our upcoming shows and keep up to date with the latest blockchain and digital asset analysis and thinking.